Welcome to The Out Agenda, coming to you on archive.kpfk.org. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. Rita, you know, I'm going to announce who's on the show, but I'm kind of excited about this because do you remember Roger Q. Mason? We just had him on a short time ago. Of course you remember him, obviously. But we're going to have him and Lori Meeker from the play Love Note on the show today.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for that. I'm very curious about it.
It looks like, from what I've, you know, gleaned from the whole thing, you know, really unique and really different. It's one of the things I think that's been going on with COVID is that people are figuring out how to present their art form in a different format. And this is what we have going on right here. I am pretty excited about this. I can't wait to check it out.
Well, you're a theater person, so yeah, you would.
As are you.
Yes, it's very intriguing because it's kind of like we've had some plays now that are doing radio plays like the old days, you know, during this time of COVID, and they're doing podcast plays. And this one, what I could tell from the trailer, and I know they're going to explain this, but it's like when you go to a museum and you have your, you know how they give you a cell phone or something, or so you can listen to it.
Yes.
But in this case, you bring your own cell phone and you have and your headset, and you kind of go around this maze, or I guess they give you a map, but they're going to tell us more. I'm just going by the trailer. That's all.
Oh, you've made me really excited. I can't wait.
Well, they've got a lot. So why don't we just go right into it? So
that's a great idea.
Yeah. Let's introduce our guest, Lori Meeker, who is one of the writers of the play Love Note. And one of the actors and writer also joining us is Roger Q. Mason, who was on our show not too long ago. It seems like it was just yesterday, but I think it's been months. Anyway, welcome both to the show. We're so happy to have you here. Okay, so first we're going to ask Lori a little bit about yourself. So you're one of the writers, and just give us a little background.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. So I am the lead writer of the Love Note project. The format of the Love Note project is a character has taken over Plummer Park in West Hollywood and is looking for stories of love throughout the little nooks and crannies of the park. My part of the storytelling is the collector's voice. So my writing kind of ties all of these found, discovered, magical stories that are unearthed in your adventure in the park. And that's where Roger comes in with his story.
I saw the trailer and it's very fascinating. Now, who came up with this concept?
I would say maybe 3 years ago, I came up with an idea for a project that we called, it was done through the Rogue Artist Ensemble, and it was called the Valentine Van. And in the Valentine Van, this was back in the day when we could be near each other, audiences were encouraged to enter our company's branded white van, which sounds scary, but it was really lovely. And inside the van, the collector had captured the world's greatest writer of Valentines. And so you got to go inside and meet that writer and get your custom-made Valentine. And it was a really charming experience, kind of a workshop version. And during the pandemic, the very beginning of it in March and April, as a theater company, we were kind of at a loss of how can we connect with people? You know, what are we going to do? How do we create art, and how do we ourselves even feel more connected and alive? And I had always wanted to kind of do an origin story of the person who found the world's greatest writer of Valentines. And that's where this story comes into play with this character that we're calling the collector.
It seems to work in perfectly with the pandemic, because what you're doing is keeping people kind of separate. You know, you don't have a lot of people sitting in an audience really close together. First of all, you're outside. And second of all, you're moving around, it sounds like, during the production.
Yes, exactly. And when we had first devised it almost a year ago, things were much tighter. Lockdown was in full effect. And we kind of had to put these impositions on our production. And, you know, how can we do this? And we were lucky enough to have a really great relationship with Plummer Park in the city of West Hollywood, having had some Rogue performances there in the past. And we joined forces and were able to bring this piece to the park. And it was always meant to be an individual experience for people to kind of really listen to these stories and hopefully open up something within themselves. And as the world started to reopen, we kind of started to tweak the storytelling a little bit to not only think about how can we connect with people, but how can we reconnect? How can we spark those things that we used to do every day, all the time? And how can we learn how to love each other again?
Wow, that's quite a mission.
Yeah, it's heavy, right?
Now, Roger, you're one of the performers, and you also wrote something in this play?
Yeah. So first of all, how are you all doing? It's nice to be back in the Out Agenda. This is really a wonderful and important space for queer content creators. And I just want to acknowledge the fact that you guys are doing the really important work of giving us voice and body. And visibility is so important. So I want to thank you for that. I am the writers and performers. It's funny because I got an email. I don't know if it was from Lori or from Stephanie, but one of the two of you or both of you really surprised me in a touching way, because you said you had been following my work and were familiar with me and you had been trying to figure out a way for me to come into collaboration with Rogue. And, you know, I've always admired the work that this company does. And I know another person that was involved with the group, I think they're still involved, Lisa Dring, and Lisa's who really got me hip to the magic of innovation of this company. So we, as invited co-writers, received a prompt that we had to respond to. And mine was about loss. And so I thought, okay, well, the first thing that came to me, because at the time I had recently lost my dog, which his name was Moet, and he is a Doberman. And this was a pretty significant event for me, because growing up, I didn't have a dog. So it was shocking to me, actually, that I could develop such an intense and genuine emotional relationship to this animal, the capacity to love and be attached to this animal that does not speak the same language that you do in terms of linguistic speech, but only asks to be unequivocally needed, wanted, and adored. That's the purest form of connection that we can have. And to lose the ability to express that connection is so devastating. And I didn't realize, I was having crying fits for months afterwards. And I was like, child, what the hell is wrong with you? But it was the power of love. And so when this prompt came through about loss, I started just writing about the dog. So that's how I ended up writing my piece, the one that I did in the and I think mine is the one that's in front of a lamppost. So I thought, well, dogs pissing in front of lampposts, and that's kind of where it came to me. But then either Lori or Stephanie or both were like, so who's going to read this piece? And then I got wrangled into performing it. So now all of a sudden I'm a writer and performer in Love Note. And that's what happened.
You do it so well, Roger.
Oh, thank you.
Your energy is infectious. I have to tell you that. So yeah, you're a natural performer.
Thank you.
You've been doing it your whole life, haven't you?
I really have. I have, you know, growing up, my grandmother, and it's funny because we're moving out of my childhood home, the family is, and there's an old yearbook from 1932 when my grandmother was at Prairie View, Texas A&M. Yes. And so almost 100 years old, this yearbook. And she was in the Gilpin Players. And the Gilpin Players were doing, Langston Hughes was doing a tour of the South. And they did one of his plays, and he came and saw it and complimented her on her crying scene. And so when I was growing up, I used to stand in front of my grandmother's yellow formica table and recite the entire collected poems of Langston Hughes. I had the whole book memorized, and she taught the fine and perhaps extinct art of elocution. How do you use language to move other people through the inflection of speech? And that kind of translated over time for me into a writer and performer career, because how do we use language to move people? But it started at that Yellow Formica table. And so I guess I you're right. I have been doing this my whole life, because since I could speak, I was reciting and then speaking publicly, because she was involved with various literary societies and sorority groups. And I'd come in, I was Doxy's grandson, and I'd be coming in there doing my little song and dance for the, you know, for the ladies to lunch, honey.
I would love to do a production with you. Someday I'm going to do something. You're great. You're really great. So Loria, the Rogue Artist, it's an ensemble. It's the cast. It's the same people that are in the cast that they do the writing and the acting. It's a group.
Yeah. The members of our ensemble, as well as our extended family of associate artists, are all very diverse in their backgrounds of artistry. This piece was put together by many of the people within the ensemble in our development team. And then kind of, you know, whoever was interested into bringing it further to life was welcome to join it. We have at least three people who might identify as actors who've written also other pieces in Love Note, Lisa Dring being one of them, and then Marta, and we have Sarah K. Peters also in our ensemble who wrote pieces for this. And I mean, I started off as in the group as a costume designer. I'm nominated for a couple of Ovation Awards, and I was like, this is a wonderful organization. I love the work that's going on. It's crazy. It's wild. It pushes so many boundaries, almost to the point of like, oh my God, this is crazy. How can I kind of shift my focus when costume design was not something that really felt right for me? And there was an opportunity to create work within the company and create the Valentine van and then this offshoot of this piece.
How about you, Roger?
Roger. Oh, yeah.
They go hand in hand.
That's what I thought.
And they go hand in hand, but they didn't always. And I have a very sad story to tell about how they came to be one thing. You know, when I was in middle school, I went to Pilgrim School over on 6th and Commonwealth downtown. And I would always audition for the school plays. And of course I'd get in because, you know, I had energy beyond belief then. And I remember going to the first rehearsals of these plays and then being taken out by the family. I would be taken out of the plays.
What do you mean? I'm taken out by the family.
My dad would say, you're not doing the show. Yeah, it was.
Well, what was the reasoning behind
that? Oh, well, we're on the out agenda. So we're going to talk about the gay 90s, you know, and how these parents were afraid of me becoming what they, you know, affectionately called at the time a sissy ass artist. And so what ended up happening was that you couldn't keep me out of the theater and you couldn't keep the theater out of me. We were one. So I started exploring other means by which to be involved, other more sort of respectable means by which to be involved. So basically positions of curation and authority, which were more masculinized, directing, producing, later writing. And my writing for a very long period of time was quite cerebral because it was about me proving to myself and to other people that I was worthy of being heard because of the potency of my ideas. But what I forgot was that little school child that loved to get up and sing and dance, that was what was interesting. And so what happens if you reconnect with the verve of your youth, the innocence, the unbridled, unsocialized, unmitigated joy of performing? What if you are writing as a playwright blueprints for those kinds of joyful events from the perspective of a performer? That's been the transition over the last couple of years. And it's made all the difference in the tone and the quality and the rigor and the emotionality of the writing, is to remember that I started as that performer and that that never left. No matter how policed or censored I was, you could not separate me from that joy. And so when I reconnected with it, that's when I really started working and being invited into rooms and into opportunities that that would bring me the kind of respectability that I think the family was seeking, though misguided by, you know, the status quo and all of the unfortunate hoods and biases that that inspires.
Roger, I just wanted to ask you really quickly. You mentioned that your father didn't want you to be in the plays. He didn't want you to perform.
Didn't want it. Yeah.
But what about your mother and your grandmother? Were they more supportive? Or?
My grandmother was more supportive, but you know, as she aged, you know, she became less and less involved in my day-to-day upbringing. My mother was ambivalent to it, because what you've got to remember about her is that she's a first generation immigrant from the Philippines who was sent to this country in order to send money back home. So for her, art and artistry were considered, you know, social luxuries that that were not within the cultural vocabulary that she knew. And yet, ironically, I later learned to find out that actually she had yearnings of being involved in the arts, but they were also censored by her father, who said, you need to get a trade because we're in post-World War II colonial Philippines and you ain't gonna be no artsy fartsy because you're not one of these well-to-do, you know, scions, you know, children of the upper crust. You're not sitting here, you know, doing archery and speaking French and going to Marseille on the summers. You coming home to these boondocks and struggling to get this, bail this water out of this hole, you know, get real. But isn't that the interesting thing about the next generation? The next generation doesn't have to bear the same socioeconomic intergenerational traumas as the last. And the fact that my generation has the luxury and ability to think about how art can further the human cause of a culture, that is a tremendous improvement, I think. Because that ultimately is what that previous generation was striving for, to be human and to be recognized as a citizen. So eventually she got hip to it. Now she loves to brag. Oh, my son did this. Oh, we're on off Broadway, that old New York. And I'm like, Miss Mason, honey, you need to make up your mind, honey. And of course, and if you heard my dad tell it, oh, he's the best, you know, talent manager in town. He's telling everyone, oh, let me tell you about my son did this. Oh, he did that. Oh, that. I'm like, my, how the tides have turned, honey.
So Love Note takes place in Plummer Park. Is that correct?
Yes, it does, in West Hollywood.
And what my understanding is, and I might've gotten this wrong, but you bring, it's a cell phone and your own headset.
Yeah, I mean, headphones is preferred, so you can really hear everything very clearly, but a cell phone with a data plan is all you need to experience it. And for those that aren't able to make it out to the park for one reason or another, we have a map on our website that you can print out and go on your own little walk around your own park or neighborhood. And it has the same little QR codes. You just scan it with your phone and you're able to hear each part of the story.
So I'm really kind of interested. So if we were to go to Plummer Park and we had our headphones and our phone, how does this play out? What do you do? You're up, there's different vignettes all around the park and you walk over and watch the vignette. Is that how it is? Or
there's no live actors in the piece. It's all an audio adventure. It's a sonic journey, if you will. And once you enter the park, you'll start to see these metal signs on various lampposts and gates around the park. The park's relatively small, so you can definitely, it takes about an hour to go through and experience all of the stops. But you just basically walk up to one of the signs, scan the QR code, and just listen. It's a very simple experience. A lot of our Rogue shows are thick with puppets and projection and all kinds of wonderful things. And this time we kind of wanted to attack something that was simpler, that maybe we can hopefully take to other parks, other places, other communities, and gather their stories of love. So it's, this is our first step in that direction. So it's a little bit of an experiment. It's always, I mean, we're always learning, but basically it's just the plays in your mind.
So if I cannot get to Plummer Park, because a lot of people are not going out yet. I mean, because
absolutely, of COVID. Yeah.
So I could do this in my own house or my own yard. Or
absolutely. You just go to our website, rogueartists.org/lovenote. And there's a map there that you can print out. And there's some instructions there if you don't have a printer. We've got pretty much all the bases covered. And yeah, you can do it on your own time, in your own space, if you aren't able to make it to the park.
And I want to say that I would pay a lot of money to be involved in something like that. It sounds like so much fun, and what a great way to spend some time with some friends. But you guys aren't doing that, are you? It's a free experience.
Absolutely free. It's absolutely free. I would say it's for anyone. Maybe if you've got 2 digits in your number, you can probably do this. If you've got 3, you can do this. Some of the subject matter, although it's not vulgar in any way, might be a little tough to understand for little ones. But it's absolutely free, and we're so thankful to the City of West Hollywood for providing us with this grant.
When you say that there's things that may make people a little uncomfortable, do you want to just give us kind of like a brief explanation of that, just so people would know what to expect a little bit? Like, does it deal with death, or what's it deal with?
There are some subjects in the piece that deal with loss of children, family loss. There's warnings within each piece if we felt like the subject matter might be too tough for some folks. And in those pieces, they're encouraged to go ahead and skip ahead.
Oh, so you can't skip because it might hit, you know, kind of something in you that you can't deal with right now. So I could just move on to the next story.
Yeah, there's a little bar on the bottom of the thing you can move with your finger and just kind of like skip around the story if you need to.
I was going to say, you don't have to, doesn't have to be listened to in order. You could pick it up anywhere and kind of go around randomly, or do you suggest that people do it in a particular order?
We do have an order. There's definitely a specific beginning and end. The pieces in the middle take you on a particular path through the park. So there is a little bit of a guided thing, but you would not miss anything by doing things one at a time, one a day, or skipping around. But there's definitely a beginning and an end.
Is there a certain hours, since you're on your own, is it from 9 to 5, or I can do this anytime?
It's available to you as long as you are permitted to be within the park. So you'll have to check to see what the park's current hours are. But it's the park is not gated. You can enter and leave as you would like. And obviously everything online is open 24/7. Plummer Park has a special place in our hearts with Rogues. We've done shows there before. It's a really beautiful park. There is one of the stops highlights the love of community, and we've reached out to people in the community who love Plummer Park and are in the Russian-speaking community. So people who know Plummer Park would know that there's a large portion of its fans that are in that community, and those that stop is in Russian with English subtitles. So that might be fun for some.
It's a great park. I absolutely love that park. I used to live down the street from that park. So
wonderful.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm a little further now, so it's hard for me to get to that park. But I think it's great. So if I can't, I'm happy that I can do it in my own little park, because I have a wonderful park where I live. So
absolutely. You could do it on your couch if you want.
Okay,
great. By your house plant.
So it's already, it started May 15th, and it runs to June 30th. So I can log in at any time.
That's right. Absolutely.
Roger, so tell us a little bit more about what you learned from this experience. What was so life-changing for you?
Well, you know, I think the real life experience sort of, first of all, what I'll say is the City of West Hollywood through the pandemic has been very generous in supporting artists, because I've been a part of a couple of initiatives over the last year sponsored by WeHo. And they have really done a tremendous job of keeping people working and keeping people committed to making art through these really difficult times. And what's interesting to me is that this experience is coming at a moment of transition. And perhaps a transition that when we were writing it, we didn't even know what stage of the pandemic we were going to be in. But it's sort of the timing of it is really perfect, because as they're allowing people to gather again and folks are feeling more and more comfortable being in outdoor space, this is presenting itself as an opportunity for community engagement and artistry that I think will be a pleasant activity for this spring. And for me, what I learned from doing it, I mean, just on the page, what I learned is that I really did adore that dog. I really did. And it also, well, it sort of inspired a longer piece that I'm looking at for television as well. And I can't talk about that, but it sort of did inspire, another kind of project in the TV film realm. So it taught me a lot emotionally and also artistically, but this moment of writing essentially monologue based theater, readers theater or listeners theater, is something that has been a major staple of mine since the beginning of the pandemic, because I've done a lot of work in addition to this with other companies, including 24-hour plays and back in New York. And so it's been a year of sort of really testing the pliability of my writerly muscle. And every time you sit down to write a compressed piece of work like this, it's like you've torn the machine down completely and you're having to rebuild it again. You shouldn't be relying on old tricks. It's every time, it's a new and fresh time to experience your craft and how you make work. And this time was no different. It was quite a lovely experience. And I was happy that I did it and happy that I got a chance to work with this fine group of folks.
Thank you for continuing to do your work, your art, because it's so important to a lot. We need it. I'm looking forward to my own little map out here that I can do in my adventures with the Love Note and following the collector and his clues. So thank you so much.
I'm very excited for you, Rita.
Oh, yeah.
And you all too. Thank you for doing it. So,
how do people find out more information? Where do they go?
They can head to our website, which is rogueartists.org. Also, we're on Twitter and Facebook with the same name, Rogue Artists. Twitter is rogue_artists, and all of our information is there.
Great.
We wish you guys the best of luck with this. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us
you so
on
much.
The show today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And again, our guests have been Roger Q. Mason and Lori Meeker from the new performance, Love Note.
Follow us on Twitter or email us at theoutagenda@gmail.com. I'm Rita Gonzalez.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful week.
And remember that being out is the first step to being equal. Now stay tuned for This Way Out.
I actually see a lot of parallels in the trajectory of divorced cis women and trans women. You live your life a certain way, thinking your life is going to look a certain way. And then there's a break or a realization where you're like, something hasn't worked. And then you have to start your life over.
Langston Hughes and Walt Whitman coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. UK Queen's Beach pledges conversion therapy ban. US tops yearly record for anti-queer laws in 4 months. And novel threesome upends gender in detransition, baby. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 15th, 2021. The UK government of Conservative Party Prime Minister Boris Johnson is finally moving forward with a plan to ban so-called conversion therapy. Queen Elizabeth II officially announced the move during her traditional speech at the state opening of Parliament on May 11th. Johnson has been under increasing pressure to take action against the debunked claim that queer people can be turned straight. His predecessor, Theresa May, made the ban part of her government's promises back in 2018. There may still be trouble ahead, however. A public consultation on the issue is to be held before any parliamentary consideration. And as the Queen's speech noted, the primary concern is to ensure medical professionals, religious leaders, teachers, and parents can continue to be able to have open and honest conversations with people. Nancy Kelly of the British queer advocacy group Stonewall expressed concern about those religious-related exemptions. She insisted, "We don't need a consultation to know that all practices that seek to convert, suppress, cure, or change us are dangerous, abusive, and must be banned." Veteran activist Peter Tatchell denounced what he called countless studies and consultations on the issue in the past few years. He said, "All we've had is more than 1,000 days of dithering. It's time Boris got on with it and got this ban done." Meanwhile, the Washington Blade reports that a ban on conversion therapy has died in a committee of Puerto Rico's Senate.
The Biden administration continues to reverse the repressive anti-LGBTQ actions of the previous government. This week, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra announced the reinstatement of Obama-era rules banning discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in healthcare. Those provisions of the Affordable Care Act were dumped by the outgoing administration. Becerra cited last year's Supreme Court Bostock ruling. It declared LGBTQ people protected under provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that ban employment discrimination based on sex. Becerra noted that fear of discrimination can lead individuals to forego care, which can have serious negative health consequences. The Bostock decision has been cited in other federal cases involving LGBTQ rights. Pro-queer attorneys argue that, by extension, the employment bias ruling applies to other aspects of life, including health care. The Office for Civil Rights of the Health and Human Services Department will enforce the ban on health care bias by hospitals, clinics, and health care providers.
A 20-year-old Iranian man is dead this week, murdered in an honor killing by relatives who believed his sexual orientation brought shame to the family. Alireza Fazili Manfared was beheaded by his half-brother and cousins after they saw a government letter exempting him from military service because of his sexual depravity. He had planned to flee to Turkey with his boyfriend, but his time ran out. The murderers phoned Manfared's mother to tell her where to find his mutilated body under a tree outside of town. She was reportedly hospitalized in a state of shock over the death of her only child. A 2020 report by the Iranian Lesbian and Transgender Network reported that 6 in 10 LGBTQ people in the Islamic Republic have been assaulted by family members. Iranian law punishes consensual adult same-gender sex with life in prison or execution. The advocacy group reports that Manfared's half-brother and cousins have been arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Whether or not they'll actually be prosecuted remains to be seen.
Cameroonian online fashion celebrity Shakiro and her friend Patricia were sentenced this week to 5 years in prison for attempted homosexuality. Under the legal names Lawik Njukam and Roland Moot, the two were arrested at a restaurant in the coastal city of Douala in February and have been in jail ever since. They were also convicted of failure to carry proper IDs and public indecency, presumably for wearing women's clothing. They each face another year behind bars if they fail to pay the additional equivalent of almost $400 in fines. Well-known regional LGBTQ legal advocate Allison Kalm called the arrests and sentencing a political decision and plans to appeal because there was no evidence of actual homosexual acts. They were simply dining while trans. Human Rights Watch has condemned the arrests and sentencing, calling the move part of a stepped-up government crackdown on sexual and gender minorities. Cameroon is one of more than 30 African countries that continue to criminalize same-gender sex. The Global Rights Group says that at least 53 other Cameroonians have been arrested in raids on HIV/AIDS service organizations since May 2020. Some detainees reported being beaten while in custody. Some were forced to undergo torturous anal examinations that authorities falsely believe can confirm homosexual activity.
In more encouraging news for the queer community, the Reverend Megan Rohr was elected Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's Sierra Pacific Synod on May 8th. Bishop Rohr is believed to be the first transgender person to serve as bishop in any mainstream Christian denomination. They pastored Grace Lutheran Church in San Francisco and also served as community chaplain coordinator for the San Francisco Police Department, according to the Religion News Service. The Sierra Pacific Synod ministers to 180 congregations and more than 36,000 members in Northern California and Northern Nevada. Bishops of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America serve six-year terms. The 41-year-old clergy person has not exactly been camera shy. Bishop Rohr is a well-known homeless advocate and street activist in the Bay Area and was featured on the TV series Queer Eye. They've been profiled in Cosmopolitan and Time magazines, where they describe their struggles as a young queer Christian, saying, "The people who were in my religion classes with me would sing hymns when I walked by to try to get rid of my gay demons, and I would just sing harmony. I didn't know what else to do." Bishop Rohr lives in San Francisco with their wife Laurel and the couple's two children.
2021 is already the worst year for LGBTQ rights in U.S. history. That's according to a new report from the Human Rights Campaign. Republican-controlled state legislators and governors have already passed 17 anti-queer laws this year. The previous record of 15 was set during all 12 months of 2015. The HRC also counts an additional 11 bills currently awaiting gubernatorial signatures and dozens more in process across the country. Trans youth are proving to be the most vulnerable. The HRC report was issued just as Montana's Republican Governor Greg Gianforte was signing yet another state law banning transgender athletes from participating in school sports. 69 more trans sports bans are among the more than 250 anti-queer state bills introduced so far. 35 of them prevent trans young people from accessing gender-affirming medical care. There are at least 15 so-called bathroom bills to outlaw trans people using gender-segregated public facilities that are consistent with their gender identity, such as campus restrooms and locker rooms. Meanwhile, two other queer advocacy groups have issued an open letter to the National Collegiate Athletic Association. GLAAD and Athlete Ally are urging the NCAA not to schedule its tournaments and championships in states that have enacted anti-queer laws. The country's premier collegiate sports authority did just that in 2016, when it moved events out of North Carolina after Republicans there passed the country's very first bathroom bill.
Finally, 23-year-old Owen Hercombe has been sworn in as mayor of Bangor in North Wales, the world's second out non-binary mayor. Hercombe's official ceremony was delayed by the COVID pandemic. They were actually elected at the age of 22 last year, making them the youngest mayor in the country's history. Hercombe says they fell in love with the town when they moved there to study 5 years ago. They've also been involved in local politics ever since. According to Out Magazine, Mayor Hercombe is second only to Mayor Tony Briffa of Hobsons Bay in the Australian state of Victoria, who served between 2010 and 2012. Briffa is both non-binary and intersex.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending May 15th, 2021. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. It's written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can read the transcript and listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio channel on YouTube. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Lebeau. Stay safe.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
Are you signed up for our new e-newsletter, Inside This Way Out? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming, looking back our more than three decades of broadcast history, and deepening the conversation about your favorite international LGBTQ radio show. All you have to do is email us at info@thiswayout.org. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you to anyone else, and we never will. Find out about our upcoming James Baldwin teach-in, a global queer read-in virtual pride event, live streaming on Instagram and YouTube, June 25th, 2021. Again, to receive the occasional Inside This Way Out and let us know you're listening, email us at info@thiswayout.org.
What does motherhood mean? What does womanhood mean? What does family mean?
A new trans novelist tackles complicated questions later in the program, just as classic queer literati have been doing throughout history.
Langston Hughes and Walt Whitman, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Langston Hughes was a fan of Walt Whitman's work. Like Whitman, some of Hughes' work contained literary explorations of overt homosexuality. Those include his poem Cafe 3 AM and Seven People Dancing. Other unpublished poems seem to be written to a black male lover. The short story Blessed Assurance deals with the father's anger over the queerness of his son. Both Hughes and Whitman kept their sexual orientation under wraps during their lifetime. Langston Hughes died in 1967 at age 65 from complications after abdominal surgery related to prostate cancer. Hughes's ashes were interred in Harlem under a floor medallion in the middle of the foyer in the Arthur Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture. This is the entrance to an auditorium named for Hughes. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Military personnel will have to shower with homosexual.
What do you think goes wrong when people shower with homosexuals? Do you think it's the spray makes it catching? To accept the principle that homosexuals can't shower with other people is a degree of discrimination that goes far beyond this. I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
A trans woman, her detransitioned ex, and a cis woman walk into a novel, and drama, hilarity, and truth ensue. So do great reviews for the book and a fascinating interview with the author by This Way Out's friend Rosie Wilby of Out in South London on Resonance FM.
I'm delighted to be talking to Tori Peters about a fantastic new book, Detransition Baby. Hi, Tori.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's lovely to meet you, albeit virtually, because I really loved your book. So many congratulations on it.
Thank you.
I'm going to sort of give you my personal summary as succinctly as I can of the book, but feel free to completely correct me if I'm not doing it justice, because there are a lot of layers to this, a lot of depth. But largely speaking, it tells the story of Reese, a trans woman living in Brooklyn who has a series of Fleabag-esque unstable relationships with inappropriate, unavailable men. She arms herself with a sort of protective, barbed humour, yet desperately yearns for the real love and family that seem tantalisingly just beyond her reach. So when Reese's former lover and former trans woman Ames comes to her with an unusual co-parenting proposition, also involving Ames's pregnant cis partner Katrina, it isn't something that Reese can easily dismiss. Does that sort of get to the gist of
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job. I mean, honestly, the hardest part of these interviews is when people ask me to like summarize my book, and I'm like, I don't know what to, it's hard. I might steal that from you.
feel free. Let's start by talking about Reese, because I found a lot to relate to in Reese's conflicts. I'm a cis gay woman, although I'm a cis gay woman of a certain vintage, shall we say. So I grew up in the UK in the 1980s at a time, well, that an era that has just been depicted in a TV show here called It's a Sin, which really kind of hit home just how homophobic the world was then. And I think arguably you could say homophobia was as vile and awful then as maybe transphobia is now. So I really kind of related to the idea that the sort of bourgeois existence with a nice house and a nice partner and a nice family set up and kids and all of that seems really unavailable. But also there's this sense that kind of queer possibility is evolving so quickly that it almost is becoming available, and that even makes it perhaps even more emotionally complex, because maybe you could have it all if only you could meet the right person and find the right setup for you. And Rhys illustrates some of these conflicts early on in the book by laying out what she calls the Sex and the City problem. So I wondered if you could maybe talk a bit about that, about the sort of four solutions that women have for life.
Sure. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but Rhys basically describes the Sex and the City problem. She's looking around, she's looking for ways to live, and she sees that most of the cis women around her have solved the problem of finding meaning in their 30s through the sort of archetypes depicted by the four characters of Sex and the City. You know, you can be a Miranda and have a baby. You can be a Samantha and have a career. You can be a Charlotte and have a husband, or you could be a Carrie and maybe find meaning through art or expressing yourself. But the problem for Rhys is really that those things are still just out of her grasp. You know, like each one of those options, maybe you could do it, but there are all these obstacles. So just, you know, it's tantalizingly close, but you know, to actually be respected as an artist, as a trans woman, you know, that's a path that I'm trying to forge right now. Dating as a trans woman is a whole thing, you know. And then the hardest probably is to be a mother. It's the thing that I think is the most kind of charged, and the most people are most surprised at the idea of trans women as mothers. Mm-hmm. And so for the book, I sort of was like, well, of this Sex and the City problem, I'm going to take what seems like the hardest one, the baby, and I'm going to go right at it.
Yeah, and you certainly do. But it's really interesting that you say that people are surprised about trans women becoming mothers, because you actually talk very poetically about the other type of mothering that happens within the trans community, the sort of intergenerational support and nurturing that happens amongst queer people, but particularly among trans women. So we almost are a bit hung up on mothering only meaning one thing, but I think you very, very eloquently depict how it can actually mean other things as well.
Yeah, a lot of times people leave the families that they come from and they're looking for a family. And we do end up sort of raising each other, and there are a lot of models. If there's a young trans woman who's coming to me and is like, how do I live? The model for that is inherently a little bit maternal, like from like, here's where you get your hormones, here's how you should dress. And also built into it is the sort of difficulties of the sort of maternal model where it can create hierarchies and resentments, where it's like, who are you to tell me how to live? Or you know, we all don't exactly want to be like our parents, you know, and that can also show up in sort of trans community. So I wanted to talk about mothering as it exists in queer community and in the family arrangements that people choose. But also I wanted to talk about the kind of like, I think there still is in a lot of ways a yearning for us, the sort of for having a child, for raising a child, for having that kind of stability and commitment over a period of 20 years.
Yeah, well, it longer, I guess, often. You know, we ever really stop needing our parents, much as we might like to think we don't. Let's complete the triangle of key characters and talk a little bit about Ames and Katrina, who work together and are having a relationship. And Katrina is pregnant when we first meet them both and doesn't yet know about Ames's past life as a trans woman. So tell us a little bit about Ames and Katrina and their relationship.
Ames was Rhys's girlfriend as a trans woman, and that's actually, between Rhys and Ames, was one of these complicated relationships that you find amongst trans women, where Rhys had transitioned much earlier, Ames did transition later, didn't know as much, and so there was a sort of mother-daughter dynamic between Rhys and Ames. At the same time, that they're both, you know, fully consenting adults, and they were together as girlfriends.
Yeah.
But that Ames is, over the course of Ames's time as a trans woman, when Ames was named Amy, she found it very difficult to live. She had never quite reconciled herself with her gender. And what she really didn't reconcile herself with was the sort of losses of being a trans woman, the kind of the reduced opportunities, the just kind of daily struggle. And she was pretty dissociated from herself. And after, you know, a period of time and a period of difficulty and some specific incidents that I don't want to give away spoilers, she detransitioned, and she lived as Ames, a man. And Ames went on to work in a company, didn't really tell people that much about his past, started an affair with his boss, Katrina, and he thought that he was sterile from years on hormones. Mm-hmm. It turns out, no, not so much. And he got Katrina pregnant. And I mean, it's interesting because that's the thing that people have been like, can that really happen? And I got that little detail from some people I knew who did, you know, had been on hormones for years, went off for a while, and, you know, suddenly found themselves a parent. So.
Wow. Yeah. Cause I did not know that could happen. That's really,
the medical establishment told me, and told most people I know, that that will never happen. And yet, you know, amongst, you meet enough trans people and you find that really anything's possible.
Katrina is an interesting character as well, because she's a woman of colour with a history of divorce and miscarriage. So I think it certainly seems like she has a lot of empathy when she does find out, although it's a shock to find out about Ames's past as Amy, and also to meet Reese. She seems to have a lot of empathy for queerness, and she's quite accepting of this proposition and the setup, really.
Well, she's divorced, like you said, and I actually dedicated this book to divorced cis women. And and the reason I did that is that I actually see a lot of parallels in the trajectory of divorced cis women and trans women. When I was writing this book, I was looking for sort of models on how to live, and I started reading a lot of books by divorced cis women. And the reason that I did that is that at first I was just like, there's something incredibly comforting to me about these books. And then I began to think about it, and I was like, actually, the trajectory of divorced cis women is so similar. Mm-hmm. You live your life a certain way, thinking your life is going to look a certain way, and then there's a break or a realization where you're like, something hasn't worked. There's been a failure. Then there's that break. And then you have to start your life over in a lot of ways. And you have to start your life over without reinvesting in the illusions of the past or being bitter about, you know, your reduced opportunities for the future. And that really is a challenge for trans women too. You know, I transitioned at 30, and everything I had built in my 20s felt like it went away. And yeah. I did feel the like allure of bitterness, or feeling like, that everything was so hard. So when I created Katrina, it was partly also to create a conversation between trans women like Reese and cis women like Katrina, and to have a conversation about like, what does motherhood mean? What does womanhood mean? What does family mean? And for someone like Katrina, who did, you know, spend 37 years or so of her life in a marriage and was like, it never really fully fulfilled me. Mm. And it's hard to say why. And it wasn't that she's actually queer. It was that she was constrained by a certain kind of expectations of very traditional heterosexuality and the institutions around it. And so that's when she was like, well, I don't know if queerness is going to work for me, but at least these people are trying something new. And this whole family setup, I'm open to it because I need a change, and these people are thinking about how to do a change. So I'll get on board for as far as it seems like it makes sense.
The other thing you do really well in the book is to weave in a sort of debate and discussion about queer politics and trans identity and culture.
A lot of my opinions about being trans are probably wrong. And if I say them on Twitter, you know, like they become a kind of cant or dogma or that can be attacked or can be, you know, debated in ways that aren't fun. Whereas in fiction, I can just kind of give them to a character and see how the other characters react. And what I'll often find when I have the characters playing with these ideas is that I change my mind about them. Like I might be wrong about it, or the characters will show me things that like are incorrect about these things that I thought was so brilliant. And it's a kind of place to play with it.
I really loved your book, Tori. Thank you so much for talking to me today, and all the best with it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
The book is Detransition Baby. The author is Tori Peters, and the interviewer was Rosie Wilby. Rosie's own book, The Breakup Monologues, has just been released in the UK and is coming to the US in July and Australia in August. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Marcos Najera and Michael LeBeau, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Dustin Richardson, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Rosie Wilby. Some of the music you heard was performed by The Hue, Yes, and from the TV show Sex and the City. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, a bequest from Christopher David Trentum, and donors Christopher Matthews and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WEFT Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, KTWH Two Harbors, Minnesota, 5GTR Mount Gambier, South Australia, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.